This podcast of The Exchange is sponsored by
Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity.
And Doucet Survey, serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England, now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine. Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
Enjoy the show.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. With the Senate still deliberating on the budget and revenue streams on the brains of many lawmakers, a familiar battle is playing out over casinos. The House Ways and Means Committee voted narrowly in favor of a two-casino bill from the Senate, but then Governor Hassan expressed doubt about whether there's room for two in New Hampshire. Meanwhile, some House members don't want casinos at all, including Democrat Mary Cooney.
We should not forget that dollars gambled are dollars not spent on other activities and venues that are available in the state. That is the intent of a destination casino, and most of the profits will not be kept in New Hampshire.
Also at the State House, the House Finance Committee heard testimony from those who say a reinvigorated Balsams Resort is a reinvigorated North Country. The project depends on a state-backed loan of $28 million. Here's Resources and Economic Development Commissioner Jeffrey Rose trying to reassure Committee Chair Neil Kirk.
Oh, we believe it's a viable project, and the state will get its money back. The department believes that. Yes. Thank you.
And it was another busy week in presidential politics as Democratic candidate Hillary Clinton and her Scooby van stopped in Concord on a low-key visit where she emphasized manufacturing jobs at a community college.
We need to really add prestige and distinction to the work we need done in America.
It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup today in The Exchange, and let's hear from you. Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Joining us for the roundup this week are Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University, author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. Dean, good to see you. Welcome back.
Good morning, Laura.
Also with us, Kathleen Ronay, New Hampshire State House and Politics reporter for the Associated Press. Kathleen, thanks for being here.
Happy to be here.
And also with us, Trent Spinner, executive editor of the New Hampshire Union Leader and Sunday News. And Trent, welcome to the Friday News Roundup. Good to have you.
Thanks for having me.
Well, all of you, I did want to start with medical marijuana. And Kathleen, start with you. At a state Senate committee hearing this week, advocates for certain medical causes made their case that medical marijuana should be allowed to ease their suffering, not necessarily cure, but ease the pain and suffering that they go through. Just remind us of the illnesses that are eligible now, Kathleen, and some of the ones that they want to add to the list.
Yeah, so as we all know, the medical marijuana law is in place right now, but none of the dispensaries are up and running. So just want to put that out there that right now there's no way for people to access the medical marijuana. And what they want to do is they want to add there's a variety of illnesses right now that you can get medical marijuana for.
Pretty short list from what I understand.
Yeah, and they want to add epilepsy, lupus, Parkinson's, and dementia associated with Alzheimer's to the list. So this bill has already passed the House. Now it's up before the Senate, and they're was some pretty compelling testimony before the Senate Health Committee of a lot of, I think it was parents coming forward, definitely a few parents talking about their children's struggles with epilepsy and how they really think that this is something that would help them. So it's a pretty, I would say, modest expansion of the law that's already in place. But if I do think something like this came up last year, and for whatever reason, it didn't pass. But it is already through the House, so it's going to we'll see how the Senate committee recommends it and sends it to the floor.
What does this look like, Dean? Because this has come up before. People wanting to add certain contingents, PTSD or other conditions.
Right, and PTSD was one of the issues that was discussed when this was passed back in 2013. You know, the current list is very small. It's basically cancer, ALS, glaucoma, I think brain injury and muscular dystrophy. If you remember back in 2013 when this was being discussed, Governor Hassan and some others who had kind of conditional support for the idea, they pressed very hard to keep it to a very narrow list. And, you know, one of the key issues discussed was PTSD, but there were others as well. You know, 19 states have medical marijuana laws. And in some of these states, it's a much broader array of conditions. You can get a marijuana prescription for anxiety, for example. But, you know, here in New Hampshire, the kind of the prerequisite for getting this through and having the governor sign it was this very narrow list. So, you know, there are going to be some who are going to argue that this is a bit of a slippery slope. Every time you add additional conditions, there's a sort of another constituency for it. So we'll see what happens. But there has been some resistance.
Kathleen?
Yeah. And I think we're probably also going to hear some arguments that we need to wait and see once the law actually – once things get up and running, how it's working with the conditions that are already in law before we start talking about adding more. Because we really don't have a sense yet of how this is all going to go once these dispensaries are up and running.
And Trent, what jumps out at you from this, either this specific effort to expand the list a little bit or just this broader sort of back and forth over medical marijuana here in the state?
I think the back and forth is interesting. And the other thing that I think is really interesting is that we have a long way to go. Even if this passes, those dispensaries, as Kathleen mentioned, they have not been licensed. They're not up and running. I believe there are going to be four licenses. And a lot of towns are grappling with how do we build something like this in our community? What are the zoning laws? What should it look like? What times of the day should it be open? So there's still a long way to go on this one.
Yeah. Kathleen?
One more thing. They've also had a couple bills about the dispensaries going through the House and Senate. There was some worry that there was a loophole in the original law that would have exempted these dispensaries from paying property taxes. So I know that the House has passed a bill that says, you know, makes clear that, yeah, these will have to pay property taxes. There's also a bill that was going through something like preventing accountants who provide services for these dispensaries from, like, facing criminal charges or something. I don't know how they would, but I guess there's some kind of worry that if you do business with a marijuana dispensary that you might get in trouble. So they're trying to also make sure that that doesn't happen. So you see that it's really complicated, I think, in ways that maybe people didn't necessarily realize at the beginning. And that's all part of, you know, the delayed process that has some advocates for this pretty upset that this is not up and running yet.
Wow, it is complicated. And you have this weird thing where it's allowed under state law, but under federal law, it's still a banned substance and so forth. So I'm sure this is something we'll be following up on next week and the week after. I did want to turn to casinos. That's another perennial story here in New Hampshire. And Dean Spiliotis, we heard this week from Governor Hassan on casinos, and it wasn't the message that some folks expected. What did she say?
Yeah, well, she basically said she's not sure that the state can support two casinos. You know, her proposal in the last biennium had been for a single high-end casino in the state. The bill that was just voted out of House Ways and Means, 11-10, goes back to Lou D'Alessandro in the Senate, proposes two casinos, a larger one and a smaller one, a total of $120 million in licensing fees. I think roughly 40, 80 or something like that in terms of millions. So the question is, in this new legislation, you know, we all assume that she wants casinos, but yet she comes out and says she's not sure whether the states can support two. Supporters of the bill have said that the way that the bill deals with that is there's a one-year waiting period between the initial large casino and assuming the second casino, the small one would come second. So there's a one-year waiting period and there's also an audit. So they're arguing that they've built in safeguards that if the economy and the demand isn't there, they won't necessarily license two casinos. But, you know, we don't know necessarily that she'll oppose it. She has just expressed concern that the state can't support both casinos.
Trent, were you surprised by that? Because I was kind of taken back. I think of Governor Hassan as a supporter of expanded gambling. And yet here she said, maybe not.
I don't know if I was that surprised, you know, and she hasn't really said anything like this before. So I guess in that way, it's surprising. But, you know, I think there's still a long way to go on this, too. And Manchester's own Senator Lou D'Alessandro said, you know, that's hogwash. We can definitely support two casinos here.
Yeah. Kathleen.
I think, you know, for me, it was interesting because I know I have, and a lot of the other reporters have been trying to get her to say something about this two casino bill since last year, when the two casino bill was the one that came close to passing. So I think that it was newsworthy that she finally decided to come out and say, you know, I'm not sure that we're ready for two. Ultimately, you know, I didn't get any – she didn't go as far to say I would block this. She just said I need to understand this bill a little bit more before I'd make a final decision. And I think, you know, there is still a long way to go. So if this passes the House – on the floor, which is supposed to come up next week, then it has to go to a second House committee, then it has to come back to the House floor. So there's plenty of time. You know, this is not a done deal. It is significant that it got an ought to pass recommendation out of the Ways and Means Committee, but
just,
you know,
barely.
we're still a long ways away. And I think that you know, it's definitely not the message that people who are supporting this bill wanted to hear. And I also think it's a little interesting because this is the only casino bill this year. You know, it's not like they're choosing between two. It's not like there's a two casino bill and a one casino bill. This is the one that's out there, and it getting amended to become a one casino bill is highly, highly unlikely. So it's going to be interesting to see how this proceeds and how the governor reacts to it, because coming out so strongly for saying we need this revenue from casinos in the past, I think it'd be very difficult for her, if it were to come to her desk, to make the case that she wouldn't sign it. So I'm, you know, she knew what she was doing when she made that comment. I'm just not sure what the, I think what it does is it gives some skeptical House members a reason not to vote for the bill, which is interesting.
It raises a second set of issues as well. You know, so much of the discussion about casinos has been about kind of the negative effects of it on the community, you know, gambling addiction, things like that. But there's another kind of economic viability argument that opponents are now raising. You know, you look at the number of casinos that have closed in New Jersey. You look at some of the issues that the Connecticut casinos have had in terms of a drop in revenue, the possibility of having casinos next door in Massachusetts. So there's this whole sort of economic uncertainty issue that now goes along with the kind of the impact on the community. And I think I think she's sort of at least sort of acknowledging that. I find it hard to believe that, given how hard people have pushed for casinos and how hard she pushed the last time around, that she would say no to a bill like this. But I think she wants to sort of express the appropriate concern.
Trent?
And I think the real question here is what happens in the full House. Yes, this passed out of committee, but like you said, it was a very close vote, one vote. And last time the House took up casino, it failed by one vote. So, you know, the Senate's okay, the governor's on board, but the question is, what happens in the whole House?
Well, we'll be following it for sure. And it's a winding road, as you said, Kathleen. Coming up, I want to talk about another story that also involves Governor Hassan. And Trent, I'll turn to you first on this one. Your lead political reporter, Dan Tuohy, reported this week that Governor Hassan's email got swept up in that Sony Pictures hacking incident of a while back. So we'll talk about that. We also got some Facebook comments on casinos. Nancy says she hopes the bill is defeated. It will not bring the revenue in that we need. Terry Clark calls it also another tax on the poor. Thanks for those Facebook comments. We'll share more of your thoughts after a short break. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. It's the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup today in The Exchange, and we're covering some of the top stories of the week. In a moment, we'll look at presidential primary politics. As soon as a huge group of Republican hopefuls swept out of the state, Hillary Clinton swept in. In just a few minutes, we'll turn our eyes to presidential politics here in New Hampshire. We want to hear from you as well. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, 1-800-892-6477. But all of you, before we turn to presidential politics, and there was a lot this week in the Granite State, Trent Spinner, I wanted to turn to you first. As I said before the break, Dan Tuohy this week broke the story that Governor Hassan's email got caught up in that Sony Pictures hacking incident of a couple months ago. Before we talk about Governor Hassan, Trent, just remind us, please, of the bigger story here. This came out a while ago, this Sony Pictures thing.
This came out a while ago, and it's still unclear what really happened. But the storyline goes that Sony Pictures produced the silly movie. North Korea was upset about it. They hacked Sony's emails. And what happened was the CEO of Sony, all of his emails were posted on WikiLeaks a couple of days ago. So fast forward to how that impacts us here in New Hampshire. Governor Hassan's emails are in the WikiLeaks dump. So we took a look at them. There were a couple of dozen. And what we found, there was I just want to start by saying there was nothing illegal. There was nothing immoral. All this was sort of a behind-the-scenes look at, you know, how a politician fundraises from big money donors. And so what we saw was the governor emailing the CEO of Sony from her personal email account, her Gmail account.
Because it turns out they're friends.
They're friends. He went to Exeter Academy where her husband is headmaster. And so they've known the two families have known each other for a long time. And there's all kinds of other personal items in there that we didn't report on. But what was interesting to us was the behind the scenes look at how the governor raises money. And you can see her saying, I'm coming out to L.A. I'd like you to donate $7,000 to my campaign. I'm governor. My favorite quote in the whole exchange was she says, I absolutely love being governor. And she says, you know, we passed Medicaid expansion and that's a great day in the office for me. And you can see her emailing this to the CEO of Sony. And she says, well, I'm going to be out there. So I'd like to talk about possibly a donation, $7,000. And I'd like to see if you would be willing to donate $10,000 on my behalf to the New Hampshire Democratic Party. And then there's another email exchange where his assistant gets involved and he says, you know, I'll give you the $7,000, but forget about the 10 grand for the party.
So I'm interested in you personally. I like you, but not so much that I also want to support
right.
New Hampshire Democrats. What are the ethics, Trent, of reporting on leaked emails like this? I mean, these are not supposed to be out there.
These are not supposed to be out there. And it is a difficult decision. These are stolen emails. These are personal emails. These are not from her work account. These are from her Gmail. And there are discussions about her kids and other matters. And my decision was I think it's fine to report on stuff that's public, or, you know, that relates to her public office. But other stuff about, you know, all these other things, we didn't touch them.
It's all up there, though.
It's all up there.
Right?
Yep.
So someone else could decide, you know, I'm going to report on her relationship with her children or her husband or whatever.
Sure. Somebody else could do that. If somebody really wanted to go read all these emails, they could. And the other thing was that this is a searchable database. So we looked for all, you know, all kinds of other New Hampshire politicians. But like you mentioned, these two families are friends. So there was a connection. And I don't think other politicians had that.
Yeah, it's a little disturbing, though, right? I mean, who knows what emails are going to be put out there about what? It almost makes you think you should just pick up the phone and call someone. I don't know.
Well,
I mean,
there is that old saying that if you know, don't write it down unless you want to see it on the front
page
of the paper.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, Kathleen and Dean, love your thoughts. Go ahead, Kathleen.
I think what it probably does is it is just kind of a reality check, you know, for all politicians that you know, you have to be, as Trent said, you know, there was nothing, you know, illegal or whatever in these emails. Everything was very like above board. But I think it's just another reminder that, you know, you do really have to be careful about what goes in emails because you never know when something like this might happen. I think what's interesting is we've already seen the New Hampshire Republican Party turning this into a political issue. They sent out an email saying, you know, Maggie Hassan cares more about the rich Hollywood liberals. You know, they're backing her campaign. She's beholden to them. So, you know, turn into this whole thing. And it's one donation. You know, I'm sure obviously this it's all public information. If we had looked through her entire donor list, we all could have found, you know, Michael Linton, Sony CEO, giving $7,000 to her campaign. This is not something that's secret or shielded, you know, but of course, you know, they've seized on this opportunity to, you know, make her look like somebody who, you know, doesn't care about New Hampshire and is associating with the Hollywood elites. They're backing her campaign, et cetera, et cetera. I'm sure it's something that's probably going to, you know, kind of blow over. But it definitely is, as Trent says, you know, a little interesting tidbit of news that just gives us a look at, you know, what it takes to run these kind of campaigns. And she says in one of the emails, she says, you know, I love being governor, but I have to run every 2 years in New Hampshire. And, you know, I think we forget that in most states, people are not running every 2 years for governor. So it's an interesting window into that world.
Right. But if we had looked at the, you know, the campaign filings, we would have seen that $7,000.
Yeah, you can see that. You can absolutely see the donation.
It's interesting to get the personal
backstory
behind
it.
Yeah. Dean, the politics of this, you know, all is fair game, right, in politics.
Sure. You know, we know that elected officials, particularly, you know, statewide officials, governor, senator, member of the House of Representatives and Congress, spend a lot of their time raising money. That's what they do when it costs, you know, $5, $10 million, $20 million to run for a seat. You got to raise a lot of money. And it's one of the things that I hear from members who they complain all the time about how much they don't like having to raise money. But it's part of the process. I think, you know, what kind of makes it sexy here is the Sony WikiLeaks angle on things. But, you know, the idea of an elected official hitting up a friend or an acquaintance who's wealthy for a donation is pretty much as old as politics.
Well, again, our number here on the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup is 1-800-892-6477. Join us as we cover some of the top stories of the week. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, find us on Facebook or Twitter. And all of you, I want to turn to Hillary Clinton's visit to the state. As soon as that big group of Republicans left, Mrs. Clinton came in. I've got a couple emails that came in just this morning on Hillary Clinton's visit. Here's one that came in yesterday from Peg. She says, as a staunch Democrat, I was extremely disappointed in her visit to New Hampshire. Her, quote, chat with regular people was controlled and only screened participants and screened questions. Her spokesperson said she didn't speak about Keystone Pipeline because, quote, New Hampshire people aren't interested in it. Her whole visit sent the message that she's not going to address anything that might be controversial. Peggy says, I don't think young voters are going to be impressed with this highly orchestrated, richly funded campaign lacking in any substance. Just, Trent, you first, give us the backstory here for just a second so we can put Peg's email in context. Mrs. Clinton is trying to do a very different type of campaigning this time around.
She's trying to do a very different campaign. And look, it's difficult to run a campaign if you're Hillary Clinton, right? You have Secret Service protection. You have all kinds of security and logistical issues. And you're trying to be this everyday person, but you're not. You can't be. And that's the big challenge, is trying to reach voters like Peggy and explain herself. Now, here's the other challenge that she's facing. All these national headlines. And if you talk to the campaign, negative national headlines, if you talk to the campaign, their idea was, look, we're going to come to New Hampshire. We're going to try to do as traditional of a New Hampshire campaign stop as we can. We're going to try to connect with local voters. And what we're going to try to do is get some positive local headlines. And they think they did a good job at that. I don't think they did. If you looked at the front page of the Concord Monitor on Wednesday, not only was there a negative story about how she wasn't connecting with voters, there was a negative story about her not connecting with the media. There were two front page stories in the Concord Monitor talking about how she wasn't doing a good job. In fact, the Monitor's lead story was led with a couple of people right here in Concord who showed up at a campaign stop to even just shake her hand, and they didn't get the opportunity to do that. And I think that's going to be the big challenge for the Clinton campaign, is connecting with those voters.
Trying to be ordinary when, as you said, former First Lady, former Secretary of State, former U.S. Senator, it's hard to be ordinary wearing those shoes. Did you cover some of these events, Kathleen?
Yep. I was at the event that she did at Whitney Brothers, the furniture factory in Keene, as well as the event at NHTI. And, you know, it definitely was very, very carefully controlled. You know, she's sitting around a table in both cases with about, you know, 6 to 10 people, you know, handpicked, selected to come speak with her. In Keene, it was workers at the factory. At NHTI, it was some students and a couple educators. And then in front of them is, you know, a row, maybe a dozen people who were invited. And, you know, it's people like Steve Shurtleff or, you know, Democratic elected officials. Senator Kelly was there. So definitely really controlled. You know, this was not an audience that was going to take her out of her comfort zone with their questions. You know, I do think speaking to people who got to sit at that table, they did feel like she was listening, like she was engaging one-on-one. You know, she definitely had her talking points. I think that she wanted to hit. She keeps talking about these four fights. And one of them is, you know, building the economy of the future, not of the past, or whatever. Whatever she says. But in Keene, a couple of the audience members started asking her about substance abuse and mental health. And that's an
big
issue that's important
in New Hampshire.
Yeah. And that wasn't really the theme, you know, of what the discussion was supposed to be. I thought that she engaged with the people on it. She said it was a problem she heard in Iowa. She also said it was something that she was going to make a part of her campaign. So we'll see if, you know, that's true, or if she's, you know, telling this audience what they want to hear. I think that, you know, this is definitely just the beginning. And I think, you know, as Trent pointed out, I don't necessarily think that they got all the great headlines that they were looking for. We'll see what happens on her next trip. And, you know, I think that we're going to see a variety of different activities. But, you know, I think that it was very controlled. It was very safe. She did take questions from the media at one point about some of those bad headlines about the foundation money. Took a couple questions from Josh McKelvin at WMUR. But very playing it safe.
Yeah,
definitely playing it safe. And that's not, you know, I think there are a lot of voters out there that are, they are excited to see her and they want to see her. And I think there's got to be that feeling of, well, you know, why can't I be a part of this? Why was I not chosen? Why can't she come shake my hand on the side of the street? And they're going to have to really contend with that. You know, okay, so you're sitting at a table with six people who already knew that they supported you. I don't understand what that gains for you. So
here's another question. This relates to what you said, Kathleen, and Trent also talked about this. Dean, you know, there have been some negative national headlines about Hillary Clinton. The House committee, this is the U.S. House now, calling Clinton to testify about Benghazi and the emails, and then the book. Kathleen mentioned this, Clinton Cash, about foreign money given to the Clinton Foundation, whether it influenced State Department policy. Now, I'm sure on the Diane Rehm hour, they're going to dig into those national headlines. But, you know, it does make it difficult to control the narrative. And maybe the narrative shouldn't be so controlled. I mean, people sort of react badly to this scriptedness.
Well, her campaign has said that when she comes back for subsequent visits, the environment will be a little bit less controlled than it was this time. You know, we shall see. You know, they have this idea that they want to show that Hillary Clinton is kind of good at retail politics and connecting with voters. But as we saw, it was a very controlled environment. And Laura, you and I have talked many times about this and how it's symptomatic of larger changes and how campaigns run. Particularly if you're a front runner, you tend to be kind of very scripted and controlled. It was interesting to see it be scripted and controlled in a retail setting. Rather than in some sort of larger setting. You know, here's the issue. I mean, this really is a classic struggle over controlling the narrative. You know, Clinton wanted to talk about the economy and education and healthcare, and the national media or even the local media. The media wanted to talk about the foundation funding, the email servers, and whether or not she's going to testify before Congress. You know, this is sort of part and parcel of the Clintons. There's always going to be this sort of kind of political drama around them. If those of us who remember back to the 1990s when Bill Clinton was president, it was the same sort of thing. So, you know, we had the email servers and that was kind of a big to do. And now we have this book on Clinton Cash. That's a big to do. And there's going to be something after this and something after that. It's kind of the nature of sort of their role in the political, you know, in the political environment. So, you know, I mean, she got reasonably good reviews for these first two rollout tours in Iowa and New Hampshire, despite kind of the negative kind of interpretation by some of the media outlets that I read. And we'll see if she comes back, if they loosen up a little bit. But I was not surprised to see it scripted like this, even in a retail environment.
Go ahead, Trent, and then we'll go to our callers.
Here's what I think the bigger issue is, and I think it's behind the scenes. Yes, there are going to be voters who didn't get to shake her hand. Or I think the bigger challenge for the Clinton campaign are the high-level Democrats who aren't exactly jumping on board with the campaign yet. I think there are some people who are saying, hey, what if we had a primary? And they were not invited to meet with Secretary Clinton this trip. They were not allowed into these meetings. And then there are other high-level Democrats who were allowed into meetings because they haven't endorsed anybody or they've expressed some interest in endorsing her. And they're not exactly jumping on board just yet.
Real quick, Kathleen, and then let's go to our listeners.
Yeah, I will just note, I mentioned that Steve Shurtleff was in the audience in Concord, and he has not backed Hillary Clinton, and after the event was not willing to say that he will back her. So, I'm sure, as Trent says, there were definitely other people that weren't, you know, weren't allowed in. Steve Shurtleff was there, but he, you know, didn't come away from that saying, yeah, I'm on board.
Here's an email from Jack. He says, people in the news media appear to have concluded that Her Majesty Mrs. Clinton is A, a colossal bore, and B, worthy of continual front page and top of the hour coverage. Jack says, publishers and broadcasters must have concluded that the public would rather read and hear about Mrs. Clinton saying nothing than about lesser known candidates who might say something of substance. Jack says, sadly, they may be right. I definitely want to talk to all of you about that and what some of the Republican presidential candidates said last weekend when they were here. But we've got some callers on the line. Let's go to Beth first. She's in Keene. Hi, Beth. Go ahead. You're on The Exchange.
Hi there. I work in Keene, and I'm here every day. And I didn't know that Hillary Clinton was going to be here, but I drove down one of the back streets and just saw hordes of media everywhere and wondered what was going on. And what really struck me after I realized why they were all here was that it was all media and nobody else. it was like a ghost town. It was like nobody cared. It was a non-event, and I was actually blown away.
Okay, so Beth, you didn't catch glimpses or try and go in or anything like that?
No, and it didn't look like anybody else was trying to, which really shocked me.
Well,
and I was really interested by the front page story on the local paper where it showed a picture of her very sort of close up with a couple of, you know, other people. And it said something, you know, to the effect of she met with the head of this company and several employees. And I thought that was very telling, you know, several. That's what it looked like. It looked like maybe several people were interested in the fact that she was here.
Well, and in fact, it gets to what you talked about, Dino. It's a very focused effort on meeting with small groups, but it comes across to people like Beth as a little bit weird.
And I, you know, I think that's just how it is with Hillary Clinton. And Trent mentioned there are some real issues surrounding just kind of moving her around from place to place and the tremendous amount of local, national, international media attention that she attracts. You know, I may be proved wrong at some point, but I don't think we're going to see her just kind of wandering around Keene, going into shops and chatting with people. That's just sort of not how they typically do business. So, you know, the reality of modern campaigning for frontrunners is you kind of script these moments and then send them out for kind of a larger a larger audience around the country. I mean, it's part of the whole digital revolution in campaigning. So, you know, typically the people who just kind of wander around chatting with everybody are the ones who are trying to get traction, not the front runners.
The lesser knowns. Yeah, right. Kathleen.
Yeah, and I also think it's a concerted effort on their part to avoid the large crowds at the beginning because they don't want this, you know, 07-08 style that where she looks like she's taking things for granted, getting these huge rallies, getting all these people in the crowd. They're trying to show right now that she can connect one-on-one, and they're trying to keep it very controlled. So I have a feeling that, you know, if people like Beth and others start walking up to Whitney Furniture, you know, they're going to get turned around very, very quickly and sent away because that was not, this wasn't supposed to be an event to attract people.
Right.
All right. Well, coming up, we will talk more presidential politics. Lots of Republicans in the state about a week ago. We'll catch up on that, find out what some of the themes were. We'll also take your calls, questions, comments, 1-800-892-6477. And we'll find out what is happening with the ride-sharing service Uber in the Queen City of Manchester. All that's coming up. This is the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. This is the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Laura Kanoy. In just a moment, we'll turn to how folks who don't want to drive get around in the city of Manchester. And the taxis there, like taxi companies in many cities, have been pretty upset about the arrival of the ride-sharing service Uber. We will find out more about that in just a moment. You can join us, too, with your questions and comments, 1-800-892-6477. Dean Spiliotis is here, along with Trent Spinner and Kathleen Ronayne and all of you. Let's go right back to our listeners. Jerry's calling in from Dover. Hi, Jerry. You're on The Exchange. Go ahead.
Hi. Good morning.
Morning.
I have a comment about the way we elect our officials. I think it's crazy that the governor has to run every 2 years. And additionally, it's even worse for our congressional representatives. What happens is we get 1 year of work out of them, and then 1 year they're out raising money and campaigning. And I would propose that we need a constitutional amendment where the Congress runs every 4 years. One half of the members of each state would run every 2 years. So that way, we would not have a total changeover in Congress or the entire Congress running every 2 years.
Yeah, this is an issue that's come up before. I think, Kathleen, there have been, every couple of years there's a bill to make the New Hampshire governor a four-year term, like almost every other state. I think it's just us and Vermont that have that two-year term. So
yeah.
Go ahead real quick.
I believe it is just New Hampshire and Vermont. And there have been several efforts, but they've never passed. I think what's difficult is if you're not the party in power, then you probably want an election sooner rather than later. So it might be a little bit difficult to get that through. And I think that there's also this idea that the fact that they have to run every 2 years makes them much more accountable. And,
yes.
You know, in New Hampshire, you know, we like to really scrutinize our elected officials. So it's been tough to get that through, but it's definitely a concern that people have brought forth in the past.
Yeah,
and
Trent.
The beautiful thing is that if you don't like them, you're only stuck with them for 2 years.
But there is that pressure. Just remind us that Governor Hassan mentioned in her email to
right.
the Sony Pictures head.
Absolutely. And that's, I think that's all that these emails really showed was the intense pressure to constantly be raising money, constantly be campaigning, and even across the country, trying to get enough money to run.
Well, it's an interesting point, Jerry. Thank you very much. Don't think it'll change anytime soon, but we appreciate the point. And Tim is calling in from Durham. Hi, Tim. Go ahead. You're on the Exchange.
Well, I was at one of the events in Concord, which they're both fairly small, low-key events focused on, you know, the particular audience was there more than on the media. I was I'm one of New Hampshire's 400 state reps, and they invited all the Democratic state reps. Some and about 100 of us showed up, and they certainly actually they're concentrating undecided ones, and I'm still undecided. So I think what's going on in the party is not that they're trying to exclude the people who haven't committed to her, but she's actually trying to reach out to them. And I think there's a sense on all sides that the Democratic Party wants to be united in 2016. And we were, in fact, united in 2008. The media were asking a lot of questions about trying to raise the idea of conflict between Clinton and Obama, and they seemed to overlook the fact that she got the best job in his administration, which was the Secretary of State. So even though it was a hard-fought battle 7 years ago.
Well, Tim, let me ask you a quick question, if I could.
Yep.
What do you think? I mean, you know, I've gotten an email or two on people kind of taking issue with this very tightly scripted, small group approach. So what do you think? You were there. So I just want your thoughts on that criticism.
Well,
and people feel shut
media,
out.
I was at the New Hampshire Democratic Party, which is in the residential neighborhoods or the state house, and there were probably more people outside the event than inside the event, just because only about 100 of us showed up, and there are probably more than 100 media, and they're probably, I mean, there's always random people who want to meet these. There were supporters who, you know, weren't in that particular event, and I think she, yes, so we'll have more chances to see her. I can't really comment on that because I was one of the people who was invited to the event, and afterwards some of us did, before and after, some of us were waylaid by the press and did talk to us, and luckily I think everybody said generally good things, and, you know, we're on message, but I mean...
All right, Tim, I'm going to let you go. Thank you very much for being with us on the roundup. Kathleen, do you want to jump in? And Trent?
Yeah, I just want to point out real quick that I think that the meeting that he's speaking about was at the state Democratic Party headquarters with state elected officials. So these are not the quote-unquote real people that have been calling in saying or, you know, leaving comments or whatever, that they would like a chance to meet Hillary Clinton.
Okay. Do you want to jump into there, Trent or Dean? Dean? No. All right. Thank you, Tim, very much for calling. Let's take Mary Jane in Hanover. Hi, Mary Jane. Go ahead. You're on the Exchange.
Yeah. Hi. You know, I've been listening to, to the Exchange, and I've been listening to other radio, television radio stations about Hillary's, visit to New Hampshire. And it's just, I get so tired of listening to all the negativity. Here we have, for the first time in 250 years, 44 male presidents. We have the first time we have a, you know, besides the 2008 primary, we have a woman running for president. Everybody is just so snarky. Oh, no, she didn't shake this person's hand. Oh, no, this person didn't get to come into her meeting. Oh, no, the journalist's question wasn't answered. I mean, I heard the Hiller instinct on the Channel 7, and that was so whiny. I'm just, you know, it's not only a reflection on Hillary Clinton, it's a reflection on some of the journalism and some of the expectations of a state that, although we are the first primary in the nation, we're one of 50 states. She's not going to be able to shake everybody's hand, not going to be able to, you know, really come face-to-face with every supporter. So I think, you know, there should be a little bit more positive reporting on what positive things that she's doing. She is doing some positive things out there.
All right. Mary Jane, thank you very much. Message heard. Stop whining, press. Dean Spiliotis, what do you think? Is the press too hard on
you? I was going to say, I should point out I'm a professor. The press is arrayed in front of me on the other side of the table. Well, first of all, you see the kind of passion that the Clintons evoke on both sides of the, you know, the pro and con, and that's not going to change. There's always been a lot of drama. Anybody who remembers them from when they were in the White House in the 90s knows that we're going to be in for more of that. But it also makes her kind of a very interesting candidate, given her experience, given the potential to be the first female president. There's sort of there's just a lot going on with that candidacy, and I think she's going to continue to be a bit of a lightning rod, because that's how it's always been. You know, and I think it's been an adjustment for people to kind of recalibrate her. She's no longer the Secretary of State, which people view with a less political lens than they do running for president. So I think that's been a little bit of a shock to people to kind of see her back as a full-blooded politician. So, I expect to hear, kind of more of this, people complaining on both sides. You know, it's just the nature of campaigning. It's going to be a struggle with the media. The other thing I will say just briefly is, over the course of a primary cycle, which, is over a year and long, or more, if you include the invisible primary before the actual voting occurs, you're going to see the narrative kind of rise and fall. There are going to be these sorts of times where the candidates seem down, and then there's sort of a comeback story to be written. And you see that every cycle. So she'll have her bad months and she'll have her good months.
And let's not forget, Hillary Clinton isn't the only person who's in New Hampshire campaigning saying that I could be the first female president. Carly Fiorina was here all of last weekend at the GOP summit. Mm-hmm. And that was her message was, hey, look at me.
Well, and let's talk about some of those Republican presidential candidates. We talked about that a little bit on last week's roundup, but the event really hadn't kicked off until later in that morning. So all of you'd love to get your thoughts on it. Trent, first of all, just the highlights for you from this big, big meeting in Nashua. Almost 20 Republican presidential hopefuls there.
Yeah, and I'd say this kind of event hasn't really happened in New Hampshire before. And like you said, almost 20 presidential candidates, and they were speaking to about 500 to 600 different activists who paid for access to get in. The candidates didn't have to pay, but if you wanted to attend, you had to buy a ticket. And this was a packed event. It went all weekend long. There were lunch speakers and dinner speakers, and the challenge for candidates there was getting your message across, figuring out a way to have people remember you after hearing from 17 or 18 other people.
Yeah, especially if you came at the end of the line. And sure. Yet Republicans, from what I understand, Kathleen, at the event were pretty energized. They said, look, this is great. We have a long list. We have a lot of choices. So I just wonder what sort of feedback you got from people in the crowd.
Yeah. And before I address that, I do just want to harp on something that Trent said, which is that this was not freewheeling access to candidates either. People had to pay to be at this event. Many of the candidates, Jeb Bush, Chris Christie, they did not come do press gaggles after, did not take press questions. At other points in the weekend, maybe they did for other stops, and they did take some questions from the crowd. But, I think we're hearing Republicans say, oh, we have so much access, but it's not like any Joe Schmo could just walk up and go speak to Jeb Bush. So I think it's important to note that as we also talk about the access that people had to Hillary Clinton. Yeah, I think you're exactly right. A lot of voters that I talked to were saying they were so excited by how many people are up on this stage, right? People that they feel could be really credible presidential candidates, people that they would be excited to vote for. Definitely a lot of energy. I talked to one voter who said, before I came here, I was getting worried. I was thinking, who are we going to put up against Hillary Clinton? What are we going to do? And after leaving this weekend, he's energized, he's excited, sees a lot of potential here. I definitely do think it's hard in a crowd that big to break out. I don't know that anybody really did break out, but I also think what was interesting is, for the state party, like, there are really not a lot of bad headlines out of this. Nobody said anything that was, too crazy or too generated that I can recall that got a ton of negative headlines. So I think that overall, this was a very good event for them. I think it went well. I think it offered the opportunity for these guys to start talking to the activists they'll need, and also to be in the state to, engage with some people behind the scenes as well. Just as Hillary Clinton had private meetings, these candidates are having private meetings with donors or, other people that they want to support them. So it's kind of, similar things on both sides of the aisle.
Real quick, Trent, and then back to our callers.
I think there was only one big winner from that weekend, and that's Jennifer Horne, who raised $200,000 for the party in April 2015.
a long ways out from the primary. Cash in the bank is always helpful. Let's take another call, all of you. This is Glenn in Portsmouth. Hi, Glenn. You're on The Exchange. Welcome.
Hi, Laura. This is Glenn Normando, the director of Fish and Game.
Thanks for calling in, Mr. Normando.
I just wanted to just make a quick point because I've been hearing about this 1,000 bear reduction, and I don't know exactly how that got started, but it is just a little bit inaccurate. It kind of sounds like we're going out there to try to wipe out 1,000 bears, and I just wanted to mention that this plan that we've developed is really about what our population goals are over the next 10 years. And the actual bear scenario is that we would like to see the population of bears in the state be somewhere around 600 animals less over the course of that 10 years or by the time we're done. And I just wanted to bring that up because it sort of sounded like we were going to be all hands on deck there with the bear reduction program.
So it's basically you're going to issue a couple more bear hunting licenses over the next decade. Is that what this amounts to?
Well, yeah, or possibly liberalize a little bit of the season at some, you know, in certain, and generally this is in a couple of certain management areas that have more conflicts than most, bear-human conflicts, that is. But it isn't a call for all to head to the woods and take them all.
I really appreciate you calling in. It's great. Yeah. We love to be corrected because we don't want to put misinformation out there. I am curious. So you released this draft wildlife management plan. Of course, the bear issue got the biggest attention. But the overall goal then is to look at different species of wildlife and just see how the balance is between man and beast, so to put it? Or
that is exactly correct. So we take input from everybody, not just hunters and fishermen, but everyone, about what levels, especially the big game animals, because those are the ones that where overpopulation of deer, for example, can cause issues. So we're looking at what is the, not just the habitat level of support, but also the social level of support and for these populations. And then when we set our individual, you know, year-to-year hunting seasons, bag limits and all that, that all gets adjusted to what these goals are, and we monitor it every year.
You know, we've done a lot of coverage on this program, as you know, about the struggles of the moose population.
Correct.
And a lot of our listeners have sent us, you know, emails, Facebook comments, calls saying, why are we even hunting moose at all, given how much this population is struggling? Can I get your thoughts on that?
Well, the, you know, this is going to sound kind of strange, but most of these issues that moose are facing right now are irrespective of hunting. The animals taken by hunting are minimal. In some cases, we are trying to keep the ratios between cows and bulls correct. In a couple of our North Country areas, the actual population is really where we would like to see it. It's the mid-state and south where these issues are predominant, and of course, especially south of the White Mountains, the increases in deer populations have had an effect on moose because of brainworm parasites.
Oh,
but
I see.
It is just a fact that New Hampshire is at the southern edge of moose. They are well adapted to extremely cold weather. We're actually hopeful this winter may benefit them from the standpoint of these tick issues in the North Country.
All right, Mr. Norman, I'm so sorry. I got to jump in on you there, but I want to let everybody know we're going to do a broader show on hunting in a couple weeks, and you'll be talking to us then, right?
So, I will be. Thank
all right. You. All right, we'll check back in with you. Thank you very much for calling into the Roundup today. We appreciate it. And just to wrap up, I always love to end this program by asking the three of you what you're going to be covering next week. Trent, what are you going to be looking at?
Well, we're looking forward to the candidates coming back to New Hampshire. They're in Iowa picking corn right now, but we'd like to see them back here.
They pick corn in April, huh? Who's coming back specifically?
Well, Donald Trump will be back. And, you know, people like to laugh about Donald Trump, but he has leased office space. He's hiring campaign workers here.
Wow.
So this might be the time where he actually runs.
Kathleen?
It's going to be a very busy week in the New Hampshire House. They're supposed to have the two casino bill and the concealed carry bill on the table. So going to be a long Wednesday.
Wow, you'll be busy. Okay,
yes.
Dean, how about you? What are you going to be tracking?
Trent and Kathleen said it all. You got the stuff going on at the state legislature and more candidate visits.
Well, and next week on The Exchange, we're going to tackle the Sunapee controversy after the state tentatively agreed to allow limited expanded development on that state-owned mountain. So we'll be looking at that and a lot of other shows. We're going to tap into a national conversation about alcoholism and what options folks might have when AA doesn't work for them. So that's some of what we're up to next week. I want to thank all of you very much for coming in. Trent Spinner, it's great to have you. Thank you for being here.
Thanks.
Kathleen Ronan, good to see you.
Thanks, Laura.
Dean Spiliotis, we'll see you soon.
Sure thing, Laura.
The Exchange is a production of NHPR. Our engineer is Dan Colgan. The senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Producers are Faith Meixel and Jason Moon. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Knoy.